Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. No, you have not reached the wrong show. This is just me taking over. I am Chad Metz. I'm here with my co-host and normal host of the show,
Brian C. Wood.
And if you're wondering why I'm doing this one again, well, last night we walked out of a little movie, and I've referred to it as Brian's Albatross before. So this is going to be a heavy Brian show, so I'm just going to kind of keep it on the rails, and that's my job today. I plan on laughing a lot and kind of enjoying Brian's misery, because I'm a terrible person. But, you know, so if you haven't guessed what movie you saw last night, we walked out of the 2016 version of Ghostbusters.
How many people were in our auditorium, Chad?
It's more than the four people that you originally thought, but probably no more than 30. About 30, yeah. But we saw it in IMAX 3D, and not everybody wants to crank out the money for that. But there were no people waiting when we walked out, and there's another showing at 10. So, if you want to draw any conclusions from any of this...
Box Office Mojo already has tracking up, so...
Well, what did it... Last thing I saw was, like, going towards, like, 50...
48 to 50.
Okay. I don't know what they were expecting this movie to do.
I think that more than covers their budget.
So. I forget how much it cost to make this, but...
It's like $80
million. Oh, well then, yeah, they're good. But whatever they were expecting this movie to do, I would imagine that they tempered that after the trailers kept being terrible and terrible and terrible. So the question is the movie as bad as the trailers made it seem?
Let me first begin with an opening statement. I posted a very sobering statement to my Facebook in regards to this, because I saw a tweet from one Jim Vegeta that said, "Movies don't ruin childhoods." And I wanted to reinforce that I do indeed agree with this sentiment. Movies do not ruin childhoods. I still own both of the Ghostbusters movies from the 1980s. I still own the animated series on DVD. I still own all my shirts and all my my jumpsuits and everything. They still exist. And they will continue. They existed yesterday, and they exist today, and they will exist for the rest of time. Anytime I want to go back and watch those movies, I can. This new movie will not add to nor take away from my enjoyment of those movies. And the fact of the matter is also that this movie has a job to do, similar in that while we talk forever about Star Wars, this movie also had the job of introducing a new generation to what Ghostbusters is. And I take a great amount of pride and a great amount of joy in the fact that some 13-year-old is going to go into this movie and fall in love with Ghostbusters and maybe fall in love with genre-making cinema and become a movie nerd. And that's a beautiful thing. And that has nothing to do with the past. It has nothing to do with franchise filmmaking. It has nothing to do with any kind of that. It's just... It exists. The movies exist. And they aren't erased from our subconscious, unless it's the Fantastic Four, which is, you know, where you know, Fox takes it off of iTunes for a little while so people don't get confused. They took the original two Fantastic Four movies off of iTunes for a little while and stopped making them available for purchase so that people wouldn't get confused between Fantastic Four and Silver Surfer and the Josh Trank Fantastic Four.
Which is funny, because both of those two movies, the Josh Trank one and the Silver Surfer, are playing on HBO, sometimes back to back, and I laugh.
So, I mean, that's my opening statement, is I this movie does not take away from my childhood. It doesn't ruin anything for me. It just, it's an addition to, and it may be some kid's greatest thing ever, and that's awesome.
And that is a very logical and grown-up way to take this stuff.
So for the rest of the podcast, we're not going to be grown up and adults about this.
I, I saw your Facebook status, and that was the first part, and I read everything else, and it's a good take on it from somebody that was very down on this movie. You had a very good take on it, and I think you will be the most logical and rational person that was so down on the movie from henceforward.
Well, my position on the movie as a whole, and we're going to get into the good, the bad, and the good, the not so good, and the bad as we go forward here, but the movie as a whole, because I got like 7 text messages as soon as we finished from the gotten out of the movie, was like, how badly does it suck? And I'm like, I've been ranting about this movie on this podcast for pretty much a year. I went back and I counted. We've talked about this movie. We have talked about this movie 11 different times on this podcast. I've ranted on at least half of those occasions, okay? Yeah. The first reporting we did on this movie was a year ago when they announced that Bill Murray was going to cameo. So, like, I've said my piece about this movie, and so people have rightly and justly asked my opinion on it. And here's what I've told them, and this is what I posted to my Facebook. It's okay. It's not great. As far as Paul Feig movies, I still have Bridesmaids and The Heat ahead of this in terms of his movies, and I actually think there are a few episodes of The Office that he directed that were funnier than this, but, like, it's an okay movie. It's not great. It's not a steaming pile of dog mess like Batman and Robin. It's not a toy commercial. It's not a hacked-up disaster the way that Josh Trank's Fantastic Four was. It is an okay movie. And honestly, if there had never been a thing in the history of existence, as I just noticed that our recording device is sitting on top of the movie novelization.
Yeah, I knew that. I just...
If there had never been a movie that had ever been entitled Ghostbusters, and in this environment of franchise filmmaking, that this came out, and it would be a hit. It would be a craze. It would be a phenomenon, because it is a solid franchise starter. It is the equivalent of what the 2009 Star Trek movie is. By all definitions, that's not a great Star Trek movie, but it's a good enough Star Trek movie that has more of a feel of a Star Wars movie, that brings in more of a general audience and gets the franchise going again. And also, in that particular 09 Star Trek movie, they reset the canon so that, you know, they could go forward on a new timeline. Now, of course, they went on the same timeline because they had Khan in the second movie again, but, like, they had those doors open to them. Like, once they made that move, those doors were open. It's an okay movie. It's not a great movie. It's not a horrible movie. It's an okay movie and a good place to start your franchise in 2016. But we don't live in a world where this is the first Ghostbusters movie. We live in a world where there are 2 movies that have come before it, and all the living actors are in this movie, staggered out across it, and, like, it has the weight of expectations of the mantle of Ghostbusters. And so I can't judge it on the merits of being the first of its kind or being a standalone, because it's not a standalone. It exists in this other culture and climate. So, like, and that's why I said on Facebook, I've said, told my friends, it's like, if this was a movie that had just come out and had no history to it, it would be a good movie that would make good money and start a viable franchise. And that's all they can really ask for.
Yeah. I'd agree. They're not in a terrible place.
The stinger at the end puts them in a terrible place. And we'll get to at the very end, we'll get to sequels and box office and all of that. But, like, the stinger puts them in a bad place, because it's not the road you want to go down. Because that to me was almost as bad as, like, Female Slimer, where it was like, we don't need to do this, but we're gonna do it because we want to bite those hardcore fanboys, slap them one more time, and kick them one more time while they're down.
When we get to that part, we'll talk about it. I don't know if they want to slap them down, or if, I mean, they lean heavily on the old movies and referencing the old movies when that may not have been a thing they needed to do. And this is just one more of those things. But
so let's get to the good, Chad. Let's start off with the good, because we don't want to like mire Paul Feig. I wrote a very nice tweet to Paul Feig last night.
I didn't see that. So
yeah, what did you say? I wrote a very nice tweet to Paul Feig, thanking him for his time, his effort, and his perseverance.
That is a very nice tweet, because I know he's probably not going to get a whole lot of those.
No, he's not. Not but at all.
I don't think he deserves it. So
I don't think he's on Twitter right now. I think he's got his Twitter turned off.
Nah, I would be sitting in the corner somewhere drinking, just waiting for this to go over. But there are good things in this movie. So let's just go dive right into what were some of the good things.
Well, the first thing I want to say is this is the first movie since 2009 where I'm going to tell you to go buy the 3D ticket and go. Yeah. This is the best application of 3D I have seen in a movie since Avatar. You know, the Journey to the Center of the Earth movie that The Rock made good use of the 3D. But this isn't like any of the Marvel movies where, like, if you see him in 2D or 3D, it doesn't matter. Like, this actually has the jump scares are enhanced by the 3D. Like, the lasers come out at you in the 3D. Like, it actually benefits from the 3D, a 3D viewing and a 3D screening. So, while you probably don't necessarily have to spend the money on the IMAX 3D, that's the format we saw it in, and that's the format that I'm attesting to, but I'm pretty sure it's the same in the Real D, normal Real D projection. It benefits tremendously, and they did a really great job on the 3D of the movie. And, you know, making it worth the extra money to spend, which a lot of movies since 2009 haven't done.
Yeah. Pretty much anytime I see 3D movies now, it's only because I want to see it in IMAX and I'm trapped into getting 3D. But this one is, the 3D is actually worth it. I might see it again just because of the 3D, which is a testament to how good the 3D is. So, yeah, I'm with Brian. If you're going to go see it, pay the extra $3 to $5 and go see it in 3D. I would say see it in IMAX because, you know, it's the big screen.
Or if you have, if you like me and you bring your 3D glasses home when you're not in an IMAX and you just bring multiple packs of 3D glasses home because you see movies like that, you just, you know, pay the regular price and then go into the 3D version.
I have never thought of it. I can't believe I've never thought of it. You're a thief, sir. But
I am a horrible thief. Horrible. But, you know, in the mid, like, in that period between, like, 09 and 12, where, like, every movie was being shot, was being released in 3D, like, it kind of became a necessity to, like, I will see this, but I don't want to give them more money.
Yeah, it's just, because I only see them that see him in IMAX, so I'm like, I'll see it this first time, and if I go back, I'm like, oh, forget 3D. But, so, we had the 3D. What else? I see you have the music, which we're going to disagree on this.
Well, no. The new Fallout Boy thing, no.
Okay, yeah, but that's terrible.
That is terrible. But, the thing is, they have Ray Parker Jr. throughout the movie, and they make really good use of it. You know, the parallel that I would draw is a lot of people gave Jurassic Park a lot of mess, mainly because it's not a great movie. Jurassic World is not, I shouldn't say Jurassic World. Jurassic World is not a great movie on any fundamental level. But, like, one of their big flaws was the way that they used Williams' score. Like, they use it panning out of a hotel room as soon as the curtains open, revealing the fully functioning park.
Oh.
And, like, it doesn't really have that majestic majesty of, you know, the Jeep running through the big wooden frame doors for the first time. You know, it echoes it. It gives you, still gives you chills and gives you goosebumps. But it's not used right at the right time. The proper example and the parallel that I'll draw here with Ghostbusters is Star Wars. Where as soon as that first, first crawl starts, like, Williams' music is there.
Yeah.
And it just automatically takes you back to that galaxy of far, far away. And just automatically puts you back there. And if you notice, they don't start the movie in the credits with the Fallout Boy song.
No.
They use the Fallout Boy song once. And that's at the in the third act of the movie.
they, I thought it was when they got the car the first
right,
time.
Right, no, I thought it was when they get in the car at the end of the movie to go out and bust the ghost.
Maybe that's it, because yeah. I know the car is involved, and I'm like, when I heard it, I'm like, this is terrible. Why are you using this instead of what you used before? Because there's different versions of the original one, yeah. And I like every version. Except for the Fallout.
And every version fits the moment that it's in and immediately calls you back to its place in time.
Yeah, like the version that we have in the first trailers that you don't hear the whole thing, but you hear you hear it throughout. They have that
the piano,
version.
The piano music.
Yeah, you hear that throughout and throughout the trailer, and I'm like, okay, this is a kind of updated version. I can live with that. They play it in the movie. I'm like, this is really good.
For 15 seconds, and then the piano smashes into the...
Yeah. But the Fallout Boy one, that's just terrible.
But like they used Ray Parker Jr.'s theme in a very appropriate way, in a way that benefited the film as a whole, and benefited the experience. So that's why I say the music was one of the good.
Well, because the way they use it to begin this movie is just like the first one, and I know because when I walked in my house last night,
the first and the second.
The first one was on, it was actually on my TV when I walked through the door. So as soon as I walked in, it's the same exact thing. And while I liked it, I can see how some people are just going to be like,
Force Awakens.
I think it'll be worse for this one because people are already jumping on the, you're just doing the whole thing over again. And as soon as that starts, they're going to be like, I'm done. But I like the way it was used.
But the problem for me here is that this isn't a remake. Like, a remake is a beat-for-beat, shot-for-shot, moment-for-moment adaptation. They get to some of the... They hit some of the same beats. They get to some of the same places. But they take divergences here and there that vary it up just enough so that you can't say that it is a remake.
Yeah, I thought we were getting like almost in a straight remake, and then once you sit there and start watching, it's like, okay, I see they're like echoing certain things, but they're trying to make it their own too, which I think is the way they should go. But it's just, I mean, it worked for me. So next, that is
the tone,
which, yeah. I didn't have a big problem with it. It was like, I will let you go because you had the Ghostbusters background.
Well, for me, like the tone was just a really good, lighthearted, not taking itself seriously tone.
Yeah.
Like there are some of these movies that you can go back and like they are straight up like they take them, like Independence Day Resurgence. I just got out of that experience, right? Like for the first hour and a half, the hour and 10 minutes, like that movie takes itself way too seriously. And then it does a major turnaround and pivot to like classic 90s over the top action movie. Like it doesn't understand or have a good understanding of what it wants to be. It either wants to be at times it wants to be the Dark Knight, and at other times it wants to be Batman and Robin. It can't make, it doesn't, it's at odds with itself. It's an uneven film in that way. Ghostbusters at least understands what it is. Yes. And it's very much actually self-referential with...
very much so.
With several of the comments that are made and the jokes that are made. So, like, it understands what it is, and it's capitalizing on it, and it's embracing it fully. Instead of just going, dipping its toe in the water, it goes full on.
How do you... Like, I don't... By the nature of this movie, we're going to compare it to the first one. So, how the tone is consistent throughout. I don't think that's a problem in this one. But how does that tone compare to the first one?
The weird part about it is if you go back and you look at the original movie, like there's a book that they wrote, like Egon and Ray wrote a book. But they were also like scientists, or no, it's not the first one. The second one, in between the first and second one, they wrote a book. So like that was part of the canon. But like the first one, like the part of the fun of the first one movie is like Dana and Murray and like trying to figure out if she's actually like legitimately telling the truth, because she comes to them with this wild story about you know, eggs frying themselves on her counter, and you know, and Bill Murray not taking her seriously and pretending just so he can hit on her and yada yada. Like, but like the tone key is consistent throughout, and it's a lighthearted, it's a funny, it's them drinking after they get fired and deciding that this is something that they want to do. And like the tones are even. Like the tones match. They don't take themselves any more seriously, any less seriously than they did in the original. Like the tones match up, and I thought that was good. They captured the spirit of what made that first Ghostbusters movie funny. And another good thing that I liked about the movie was the tech. Put the proton packs aside, because that's an evolution throughout the movie. But, like, the superpower punch for hand-to-hand combat with Ghost, the Ghost vacuum, which reverses the wind and, like, sucks the Ghost in and like spews it out. Like a wood chipper, you know, the double barrel shotgun thing that they use, that Kristen Wiig uses.
She like, used it once, yeah.
Right. Like, and you know, the test, that's all good, like, spin-off technology. Like, if they had made the movie today, they would have had these kinds of things. They didn't have the technology, they barely had the technology to pull off Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. Yeah. Like, much less something like this. And I can totally buy the idea of this being something that Aykroyd or Ramis would have come up with, that both uses the science but also gets the laughs and works. And so that's why I really thought the tech, the Ghost tech, was a good thing about the movie, because like it really, the technology has practical applications that are based in science and also serve the purpose of hitting the beat that you need to hit in the right action set piece.
I will agree with all of that for the actual Ghostbusters. There's other tech involved by the villain, but I will say that for when we talk about that guy, which we can actually go into now since, well, no, we'll go into now because you have him not so good. I would say he's kind of bad. But, so what's the so-so, the not-so-good parts of this movie?
Well, the first thing that I want to talk about in regards to the not so good portions of the movie would be the side characters, and the main thing that I want to talk about with the side characters is Andy Garcia. One of the things that I absolutely adore and love about the original Ghostbusters is that the mayor actually looks like, if this was happening in your city, like, even if Rudy Giuliani was still the mayor of New York City, like, this is how he would have reacted. Yeah. Like, he would be freaked out and stressed out because his office would be fielding phone calls every 2 seconds from freaked out people. And, like, you know, he has an advisor who's, like, trying to sweep all this under the rug, and he's, like, dealing with the practical real-world applications of these three scientists who are sitting there telling him, we have a paranormal event that is going to bring paranormal energy the size of a Twinkie, a ginormous 3,000-pound Twinkie, to your city. And, like, him dealing with the fact that that's actually what's going to happen. And in the second movie, when he sees gets the phone call that, like, the Titanic finally arrived 85 years later, like, and he says, somebody get me the Ghostbusters. Yeah. Like, he looks like, acts like, and reacts like and feels like a normal mayor, and how an actual mayor of New York City would react to these events. Andy Garcia is a caricature of what a mayor would be like. Like, he is the quintessential, like, fingers tapping, like, evil smile, like, nothing to see here. Like,
I think his characterization of the mayor is solely so they can do the Jaws joke.
Yes, but like, even the mayor in Jaws, which is what they reference in the, by the way, I was waiting for Kristen Wiig to like get hit by a ghost or something. because she was, that's why I grabbed you, because like she was, they were at a restaurant. She's standing in front of the window.
Yeah.
In the original movie, that's when the dog takes down
Rick Moranis.
And then everybody goes, and I've heard Aykroyd and Ramis talk about that scene many, many times where they say, the reason that we put that scene in there was to show how tough New York is. And how, like, something horrible could happen. Like, this man obviously got devoured by a, supposedly what they would think is by a dog. And, like, they just went back to their conversation and their meals. Like, things just happen in New York, and you just keep going. And, like, so that's why I grabbed you there, because I was like, certainly, like, some ghost is going to come up and, like, hit her or something, and she's going to fall down. But where they do that Jaws joke, like, the mayor in Jaws takes himself very seriously and just doesn't believe Brody. He doesn't believe that the shark problem is as bad because he doesn't want to have to believe that the shark problem is that bad because he doesn't want to have to shut down the beaches on July 4th weekend.
Yeah.
Which is going to cost him a whole bunch of money. And if you notice, and I know we're getting into a review of Jaws here, but if you notice, once his kid and Brody's kid are under attack by the shark, he sobers up and he says, whatever you need.
Yeah.
Like you're not, it wasn't like he was like an over-the-top caricature of a mayor. He was just a very practical mayor who was like, unless you can show me, like, a shark fin, like, belly up in the river, in the water, I'm not gonna shut down my beach because I can't afford to. And like, they catch the shark at one point, and, a shark at one point, and he believes that that resolves the problem. Like, he has a practical reason for why he's approaching the problem the way that he is. Andy Garcia is just like, whatever hot chick over here tells me, that's what I'm going to believe.
No, I think you're very much right. He is like a caricature of a bumbling mayor. I really think they played it that way just so they can tell this Jaws joke.
But the Jaws joke doesn't even fit.
No, I didn't. I heard that there was going to be a Jaws joke. I heard it was like one of the funnier things in the second half of the movie. So when they did, when he was there, I'm like, okay, this is the part. And I'm like, all right, I mean, I get it, but it's not.
The joke at the end with the water poisoning thing is actually funnier to me.
Yeah, that is funny because he it's just, you know, doubling down on what this character has been so far. And I don't know, I just kind of attribute it to everyone in this movie that is not a Ghostbuster is a freaking moron. And I just kind of attribute it to that, because that goes through the whole thing.
Like I said, like, I thought it added authenticity to the original movie to have that mayor acting that way.
I agree.
Especially with the EPA guy. You know, the EPA guy is actually partially responsible for what happens because he forces them to shut down the machine.
And I mean, that in that mayor, he's like listening to it. Actually, you can see him contemplating it, and they persuade him by saying, "You're saving voters. You're going to save voters. You're going to save voters.
You're going to be the mayor who saved New York."
Yeah, and I think, you know, I don't know if it's in the first one or the second one, but they reference it like, you know, you can be governor, and like, you motivate him by like real political ambitions. This mayor is just like, nope.
Whatever the Homeland Security Department tells me.
Yeah, that's dumb too. But moving from the mayor, I mentioned him before, would be the villain of this movie, who I don't even remember his name.
The first thing I want to do is, like, if I ever got an opportunity to speak to Paul Feig and we'd have a very long conversation about Freaks and Geeks and then we'd move into this. Did you notice that, I'm not sure how many reviews are going to touch on this, and I'm not sure how many people are going to pick up on it, but the theme of the movie is bullying.
Yeah?
The theme of the movie is bullying. The villain is a guy who's gotten dumped on his entire life for being creepy and odd, and so he wants to get back at the world, and he doesn't want to get back at it the way that Harris and Klebold in the real world wanted to get back at the kids at Columbine, or the way that the crazed guy over in Connecticut did to those to his mom and those school kids. He does it the fictional way by, like, trying to open up a portal to become the leader of and have control of everyone, so that everyone would ultimately have to bow down to him, because forever he's been the guy who's been beat up and subservient. Same way with McCartney and Wiggs characters. They grew up as ghost girls, which is a term that gets thrown around a lot in the movie, which is a term for the fact that both McCartney and Wiggs characters have been seeing ghosts since they were very young and were always into ghosts and telling really cool ghost stories and were maligned for it and made fun of it. And Wiggs' character spent years going through counseling because her parents thought she was crazy because she had this paranormal experience. And so she, you know, the theme of the movie is bullying and how you deal with it. And, like, the difference really, the only real tangible difference between the villain and the heroes, and these two heroes in this particular instance, is that the heroes had one another to lean on while they were going through everything. Like, they could help one another get through the bullying and the being made fun of and the missing parties and all of that, because they knew that they were right and they had each other to talk to and get through. He didn't have anybody. Like, he was so bad off. Like, the waitresses at the coffee bar were, like, flipping a coin to see whose turn it was this week to wait on him because they didn't want to wait on him. Like, he's the guy who, like, is made to go clean up a really bad toilet overflow in a hotel room, and his boss makes fun of him as he orders him to do it. Like, he has no respect from anyone at all. And so his motivation is, I want to open up this portal. I want to let these spirits out so that I can be big, I can be bad, and I can be the one in charge for a change and turn the tables on everybody.
Having heard you say all that, I would agree with all of that. But I don't think they did a good job of showing that through him, because when we first meet him, he's just like this weird guy talking to himself. And
I agree that the subway scene was not the best way to introduce him. The hotel scene,
that might have been better,
where you see all the plans on the wall and you hear him explain his plan essentially with that saying that he keeps repeating over and over and over again, parallel the lines, activate the, you know, whatever, like that saying he keeps saying over and over and again, like, that might have been a better way to introduce him. But, I mean, I get where he was, what he was trying to do. And I like the fact that he was reading their book and taking their science and applying it to this little-known paranormal activity theory to create the portal.
And that would be my issue with him. Like, the character development stuff, I did get that, you know, he was bullied, and that's why, that was his motivation.
Well, look at the drawing in the book.
Yeah. So, I got that. I don't, you describing it, you just going through everything, makes it feel a little bit better. But, in the movie, the Ghostbusters develop their tech, and it's Holtzman that kind of does it, and they lay out how, and she's still figuring stuff out as she goes along.
He has
his big elaborate setup, and he's made these little devices to amplify
paranormal activity.
Yeah, and then he's got this big setup that's going to tear a hole in New York, and he's doing it based off of their book, but they barely can make a trap by the time they actually start being Ghostbusters.
And my answer to that would be that he was taking some of the experimental elements and theories that they had in the book and making them reality. Now, the other problem with that is this dude's a bellhop. He ain't exactly a Nobel Prize physicist. So that's part of the problem with, you know, him taking the words of like, really smart physicists and actually doing that work. Like, there's not an online tutorial for how to deal with these kinds of things or do these kinds of things. That's the other suspension of disbelief here.
And this book hasn't been released.
It has been released because she had to sell it in order to help make the money, because that's the whole introduction of Wig and McCartney's characters, is that Wig is at odds because she's trying to be this distinguished, normalized professor, and here's her friend many years taking the book that they wrote together about their ghost beliefs and selling it to make money to keep the hope and dream alive of what they were doing.
That is the whole thing that sets the story in motion. It just seems like the book hasn't been on sale that long, because when she finds out about it, she's like, there's only two copies, I burned both of them. And then she finds out she has it, she's selling it online, which would mean...
On hard copy, ebook, and audiobook.
Yeah. And for her not to know about it, and to get through all the tenure process to this one point, and then find out that it exists, says that that book's not been online that long. So he hadn't had it that long, and while he says he's a genius, we can give him credit for that. He doesn't have like the background necessary. Even a genius needs some kind of background to make all this stuff.
And geniuses don't become bellhops.
Yeah. Well, they can if they're as weird as he is and have his issues. But we have to suspend disbelief for that. I mean, this is one of those, I have weird nitpicky things on stuff, and this is one of them. But I get it. We got to the villain, and now it's the... Oh, set up for the third act.
I get that what they do with the PR spinning, and like, we have to make these people seem like they are not, like, they're crazy and they're just publicity hounds, like trying to get more money. But like the setup for the third act, like what I'm talking about there is mostly like the creepy, like cutting in and out between between what McCartney and Wig and them are doing and what he's doing. And like the repeating of the phrase and like the creepy drawings and like kind of, and I know this is going to upset some people, but like it kind of reminded me of the museum curator in part two, because you know the painting guy can't move out of that painting, so he takes over the curator guy to basically do all the setup work for him so that he can eventually do what he needs to do. So that's who he kind of reminded me of. But like the setup for the third act, it like what I didn't like about it was the idea of him basically putting an end to it, right? Like he commits suicide instead of amplifying the machine. Now, of course, it's part of his plan, but like it feels like a false ending, pretty much. And like I'm not really pleased with that, because that's not in the first two movies. Like the first two movies have a clear build up and then a payoff. Here it seemed to me more like build up, sort of payoff, and then like lull, and then like real third act payoff.
I can see that. I have more issues with the third act itself than the build up.
That's in the bad.
Yeah. It's. I don't know. It's just part of the thing. I do agree with the whole him killing himself and the
because because like you expect at that point for him just to flip the switch and just to start the machine, and then we just get into what we get into.
Yeah, you don't have to. He doesn't have to like kill himself and then everybody leave and then him hit the switch. It was just an excuse to have the whole crazy scene or the jail scene like in the other two. Which they could have done a different way.
They don't really have the crazy jail scene here, where episode one, Star Wars episode one on the DVD, Lucas's commentary. Lucas talks about the fact that every movie has to have an exposition dump, and most of the time that exposition dump is done while repeating people's characters sitting around talking around the table or doing something. In this particular case, when they're all in jail, that's when they lay out the plans, yeah, and they realize that, like, okay, well, Dana's apartment building sits on top of this ancient Indian burial ground, which has this long history of
all this ghost
stuff. Yeah. Yeah, like, but in this particular case, before any of that,
it's like right before they do that.
Right. Before they, like, they don't go to jail to do that, to find the line and to follow the line and do the X's of the spottings of all the different ghosts and, like, tracing the line through the X's and realizing where this guy is going to be. Like, they don't go to jail to have to do that. They just get made fun of on the news by the mayor and, like, ridiculed and hauled away by Homeland Security for some odd reason.
Yeah, when you say that, yeah, I'm like, they did the exposition dump right before that, so there really was no need for them to do it except to
do possession, which had not been done yet, to do possession both with McCartney and then with Hemsworth.
Okay.
And Hemsworth is totally a good in this movie. Like, one thing I'm excited about is the fact that no one saw Vacation. I paid money. I saw Vacation. Okay, he has comedic chops, and he shows them off in that movie. And hopefully, more people will see Ghostbusters because I know it's going to make more opening weekend than Vacation did. And hopefully, more people will get to see the comedic side of Hemsworth, which will open himself up hopefully to different roles than just, you know, Thor.
Yeah. I haven't seen Vacation. I've heard he's a very good part of Vacation, but
Him doing a Texas accent is just hilarious.
Might have to watch it when I go home. It's on HBO. I just haven't done it. He's a good, except again, he's just like dumb as a bag of rocks. And I think they did that on purpose to, you know, juxtapose. You have all the girls, so we're just gonna make
taking the stereotype of the good-looking girl who actually isn't very good at her job but is kept around because she looks very good and she's eye candy for the guys who work there.
Yeah, and I appreciate them giving him something to do at the end when he's
gender. It's gender reconstruction. It's a gender reversal.
Yeah, when at the end when he's possessed by the ghost, he actually has something to do, and the end credit scenes is all owned by Chris Hemsworth, so I would, yeah.
Well, but that's set up by the dance number that, you know, they was just inherent to having them all pose that way.
Yeah, I think they were going to put that in the scene, the movie, and they were like, we're not, but it's still too good to lose, so they put it in the credits. But now we get to the bad, and we agree on the first bad, and that would be the cameos.
Would you like to tell the fine folks what happened every time a cameo appeared on the screen?
Brian is sitting... he's sitting next to me, but there's a chair between us. So every time somebody comes...
So that you could not be identified as associating with me in case I decided...
I walked in with you, talking to you. There was no getting away from
me. Oh, I didn't just talk.
Yeah. He announced himself to the audience. What was it? Who you going to call?
Yes.
Now, he said this while wearing a Ghostbuster jumpsuit. And he's walking with me. There's no getting away from it at that point. You've brought all the attention down on both of us. I couldn't disavow you if I wanted to at that point. But every time one of these cameos came up, Brian would reach across the seat and he grabbed my arm. And he started counting down. So at one point, I started counting down with him when I saw the taxi cab pull up. I'm like, I know this is Dan Aykroyd. So I just held up four fingers because he was the fourth cameo at that point. With the exception of Harold Ramis and
Annie Potts.
Annie Potts was a good one. I didn't mind Ernie Hudson. I like Sigourney Weaver's. I know you didn't see it. I know other people don't like it. I like those. Well, that kind of leaves just two, which would be Dan Aykroyd and...
Well, here's the thing. The reason the cameos are... Look, let me be very clear about this. My great fear and concern with the cameos was, is it going to take me out of the movie? They don't take you out of the movie. All of them are very minimal, with the exception of Murray's. Uh-huh. Like, they're blinking, you miss them type things. So, like, the cameos don't take you out of the movie. Yes, they all have different character names. They are not the same people. Murray gets his wish. Murray gets his wish and dies. Doesn't come back as a ghost, but gets his wish and dies.
Yeah.
But, like, they're unnecessary. Like, if you take those cameos out, they add nothing to the movie, and they don't take anything away from the movie.
No.
Like, I mean, I understand what they're trying to do with Murray. What they're trying to do is make him the EPA guy from the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm gonna dare you to open that up so that you can release a ghost and show me that ghosts actually exist. When I know that if ghosts actually exist, it's gonna be a problem when you let one out.
Yeah.
But the cameos don't add anything to the movie.
No, they don't.
And they don't take anything away from the movie.
But Annie Potts is one I like, just because of what it deals with.
Annie Potts is a function of the plot.
Yes.
Which works. And Ernie Hudson's is a function of the plot, because she talks about her uncle
the whole movie. Yeah.
And it makes sense for the one black guy from the previous movie to be related to the one black woman.
I
mean,
she kept saying her uncle the whole time. I didn't even think about it until the end when that car showed up. I'm like, oh, we haven't seen Ernie Hudson. Okay, this makes sense. I'll allow it. But Annie Potts, and because it's Annie Potts and how she delivers stuff, she's talking
with
about
the same accent on the phone with the same
attitude. And because she's talking about the villain in the movie, who everybody thinks is a weirdo and talks down upon, her talking about it fits into what they want to go with.
Reinforces what everybody believes about
him. Yeah, so, like, all the cameos, I can get rid of all of them except for hers, because it actually works. It serves the story. Dan Aykroyd's cameo
goes on too long.
It's
half a beat too long, and his accent's too thick. You can't really understand every word that he's saying.
Except when he starts quoting lines from the first one, which is what the whole not taking you out of the movie part, because he said those lines.
Murray does too. Murray's last line of the movie is Casper, which is what he says when he sees Slimer for the first time.
Yeah, I did not like Bill Murray's cameo, maybe because it was so long. Like, if it would just been the actual TV spot, maybe I would have been okay. But then he actually comes and shows up, and it's like, okay, this may be a bit too much. I just could have done without all of them. I would have kept Annie. I was really amused by Sigourney Weaver's, just because it was a girl power quote, and it made fun of the containment unit. They didn't have a containment unit in this movie. She's building one, and then they say the warning lights are for boys. And give a high five, so it's a nod to the other ones. And it's one of the nods that I like. So, I liked hers. And I just thought it was a good move to have the Harold Ramis bust at the beginning of the movie.
Oh, yeah. Which is a small one that no one's really going to
notice. If you don't know who Harold Ramis is.
Or what he looks like.
Yeah, you wouldn't catch it. I mean, they hold on it for just a beat so you can see that's him. But if you're not looking for it, you might miss it. But I like that one. Now we get to the third act of the movie. I'll let you take your shot at it first.
So much. So we're going to use a hotel instead of an apartment building. We're going to put the device in the basement, not on the roof. And we're going to separate our protagonist so that, like, Kristen Wiig is separate from where McCartney in that group is. We're gonna have Slimer basically hijack Ecto-1 and drive around up in it with Mrs. Slimer and a bunch of ghosts and just have a party and drop some line about basically the equipment on top of Ecto-1 being the equivalent of a nuclear reactor. Without ever really explaining how that actually works. We're gonna have basically a pre-trial. Like, a pre-test. Like, we're gonna... Like, the balloons, like, are the thing that, like, he puts in their way to, like,
Distract them or hinder
them from getting to him. Which is silly, because he has that line where he says girls are never on time. So, like, he's clearly up on that marquee he's mimicked the shot that he did the drawing with, He's mimicked the shot with all of them doing this. So, like, he's got all the army personnel frozen, and he says, you know, it's always like girls to be late. And so why would you even block them from getting to you if you're just waiting for them? The Stay Puft Marshmallow Man as a balloon. Again, all this stuff works really well because of the 3D, and it really does make it fun. Giving Kristen Wiig her hero moment with the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man is nice. But, like, instead of crossing the streams, you just reverse the plurality, and you do it by some, like, mechanism that I can't even, like... we're gonna throw a nuclear reactor down its hole and then hit it with the proton packs and explode it, and then that's gonna create a polar vortex that is gonna suck everything back in. And then, like, as we had both feared from that New York Comic Con pop vinyl that you had sent me, like, they did legitimately take the logo ghost and turn him into this movie's version of Stay Puft.
So, about before I give my third egg thoughts, the logo ghost. So, I know most people are not going to like this. The whole mechanism of how he comes about...
It's a complete botch of the original. Where Gozer says, or Azul says to the Ghostbusters, choose the method of your own destruction. And Murray is like, everybody, look, like, just empty your mind, don't think about anything. And next thing you know, Zool says, it is chosen, and you hear the big footsteps, and Ray just starts crapping his pants, because he's like, I thought of the most friendliest thing I could possibly think of, and here comes Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. Well, in this particular instance, Patty is like, well, why can't you be something nice and friendly and soft? And he's like, and he transforms into the logo ghost, and he goes, is this better? And she says, yes. And then he starts walking toward camera and becomes the giant, you know, Stay Puft sized, you know, logo ghost.
Okay, so I know it's...
Who they hit in the crotch with the protons.
Yeah. So... I know it's completely stupid, but the whole mechanism of seeing the cartoon version of the Ghostbusters symbol that
which we all know... in the cartoon, doesn't it? It
The cartoon starts with it walking down the street, like, kind of dancing between garbage cans, and he jumps and gets caught in the sign. We basically see the reverse of that, because he asks that question, and he becomes a cartoon version of the symbol, and then he's like, well, you thought I was going to stay this way, and not, and he hops out the sign, and then he becomes, like, it goes from a cartoon to, like, what these ghosts look like in this movie, like, an actualized version of that. And the cross symbol becomes his bow tie, and he starts walking down the street. I don't know why. It's stupid, but I really like that. I don't know why. Until he started moving, because then it's like, he doesn't do anything. He gets shot in the crotch, and...
Well, he's big, and he just starts taking down buildings, because he wanted the whole point of him wanting to open up this portal was to become... the leader and to become able to be the bigger of the bigger person.
It goes into what he had drawn in the book where he's like this big, huge version of himself and he's like crashing things, but he like crashed the building and then got sucked back into the hole. So
he crashes the building and then he gets hit
in the crotch and they suck him down the hole.
Yeah. Which is another, little punch to the gut to the male fan base. Like of all the ways we could take this ghost down, we're just going to hit him in the nuts with proton packs.
Yeah, that was a little bit too on the nose on that one. For me, the third act was just... it's what most blockbusters devolve into now. It's just a whole bunch of things, big things happening, explosions and buildings going down.
Unless you're Michael Bay movie, and then...
Then your whole movie is a goddamn third act.
Yeah.
I think that's a side effect of what this movie was trying to be, was a blockbuster. I just don't want to see them try this, do that again. And I think we'll get a sequel. I just don't want the blockbuster stuff again. Next, I think the references.
Yes.
Which we kind of hit on a little bit. You would get, because I'm not so much of a fan of the first one, I know there's a lot of references in there that I didn't get.
Well, when I'm talking about references, I'm talking about, like, her getting fired from Columbia.
Yeah.
Her getting fired from Columbia and having to go join, go seek out her, her McCartney. I'm talking about, like, references like the hotel, like the museum where they have the first encounter being similar to the library where they had the first encounter.
Yeah, I got that one.
I'm talking about, like, the design of the hotel looking similar to the design of the apartment building that they used in the first movie. I'm talking about using, like, the line that they use from the comment section of YouTube. Yeah, these bitches ain't gonna bust no ghost. You know, okay. Things like that.
I got that one. I laughed at it just because of the things I've heard about people doing this week that haven't seen this movie. They're really just hating it because it's a bunch of girls. So I appreciated that one, but I can see where some people wouldn't.
The fact that the villain pretty much acts the same way that the museum curator did from the first movie. The fact that Murray uses the term Casper as his last words in a Ghostbuster movie. The fact that Aykroyd, quotes those lines in his cameo. The logo itself not really changing very much from what it was.
It didn't change
at all. So that's what I mean by references, like the New York one being used for a lot of the coverage of the things. It's just a lot of references and in jokes to the original that, like, you know, it's enough to where it's like, if this is supposed to be a hard reboot, why are you referencing all of these things? It's kind of like Force Awakens. Force Awakens is a direct sequel to Return of the Jedi, yet it references A New Hope a lot more than it does Return of the Jedi.
You're not the first person to say that. Again, I didn't get a lot of them because I don't know Ghostbusters like you do. But
there was the reference to You on the Other Side. That line was used at one point, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I do remember that. But I didn't catch it in the movie. But I know if I knew them, it would have probably bothered me more. Because it's like, you're a new movie. You're trying to be your own thing. But when you load it up with so many references, it's like, we don't believe you can stand on your own. So we're going to make sure that people know that you came from this. That's kind of the vein I've heard people talk about the references, which I get.
What do you make of the new the pacing? I mean, I felt kind of like, because, like, I felt kind of like, again, one of my problems, like I said, in the not so good, is like the setup. It's like you have that lull between the suicide and then the possession, mm-hmm. and the third act, the true third act, that, like, it just kind of feels like it's lagging there.
I would say right around then is where, like, if I had a watch, it would have been the time I looked at my watch. I'll say this, as it has become more apparent here lately, if a movie has too much pacing issues and I'm not really liking it, I'll fall asleep, as you've seen. Mm-hmm. I think I did it. I did it in one of them when we were at. So the pacing was enough where that low, it made me realize that there was, like, okay, you could have got rid of this. But then when I walked out and I looked at my watch, it was like, I don't think it was like 9:15.
Yeah.
So the movie's not that long.
No.
It started at 7:00. We had previews before, so it probably didn't start until closer to like 7:20. So we're looking at less than 2 hours, which is not bad. But yeah, there are parts where it's like, you could have done without this, you could have done without that, but it doesn't wreck the movie for me.
So let's talk about that post-credit tag, shall we?
Okay, I'm going to go this one first, because I know you don't like it. again, I didn't. It's like the logical thing for what they set up. It's like, we're letting you know we have a sequel, and we're gonna give you something else that you know. So, with that, I'm like, okay, that's fine. She gonna
look like a butch lesbian?
Now that's the thing. How do they pull it off? Because if they're pulling off exactly like, I don't think they can pull it off exactly like the first one, because this movie, lesbian
dominatrix.
they have to go completely different.
They have to make him because, a male.
Well, the way that I would imagine, so they can beat up on the dude again, which again I don't have a problem with, but like this movie harkens so much back to the original one. If you're going to do a sequel with the villain from the original one, that villain can't be anything like the original movie, because you've already done the original movie.
Well, here's my thing, okay? And this is what people don't... Like, this was a movie... Ghostbusters was a movie conceived by Ramis and Aykroyd in their days after Saturday Night Live, just because born really out of Aykroyd's love of the paranormal.
Yeah.
And wanting to make a comedy about it. And if you want to get technical about it, you kind of got a spiritual sequel to, Ghostbusters and Evolution in the early 2000s, which is a Ramis directed movie with Aykroyd as a star. But like, the thing about it is, like, it was a movie created and conceived by Ramis and Aykroyd out of Aykroyd's love of the paranormal. And they had a lot of friends, obviously, in the comedy world, and they threw it together, this goofy paranormal comedy. And they filmed it, and they got the money to do it, and they filmed it, and they released it, and it became a global, worldwide phenomenon. And Columbia TriStar was like, we need more of this. And, like, this is in the mid to late 80s, like, before, like, now, like... Before, like, the 2000s, where it was, like, sequelitis, and everything needed a sequel, and everything had to be spun off into a franchise, like, that wasn't really the case back in those days. Like, but at this point, it was more along the lines of, like, Gremlins and things like that, where it's, like, a movie that was just made for the sake of making the movie, because they had the idea and the concept, and now, because it made so much money, we want you to go back and do it again, because we need more money. And so, they weren't, nowadays you conceive movies as franchises. Now you start with a plan for a trilogy, at the very least. Wasn't the case back then. And so what happened, and we all know the stories about Ghostbusters 2, and we all know the stories about how Murray claims that there was a script that they did the table read for, and then when they showed up on set it was a completely different script. But the problem that you have with Ghostbusters as a franchise in the modern conception is that it doesn't lend itself to it. Because the problem that you have is, if you look at Ghostbusters 1 and Ghostbusters 2, they're about possession. Rick Moranis and Sigourney Weaver being possessed. And Zool opening up a portal. In the second one, museum curator gets possessed, and painting guy, who decapitated 30,000 people, wants to open up a portal so that he can take over Oscar's body and live long into the 21st century. When you're doing a Paranormal Activity movie, not the Paranormal Activity brand, but like a movie about ghosts, that's kind of the only way you can go, is possession and portal. There's not a lot of room there to make a lot of sequels and have a lot of different stories, unless you're going to just turn it into a YouTube short film series where it's the new ghost-busting adventure every week, and you take, like, a case that gets called into them on a random Tuesday, and you show them going and busting a ghost. Like, there's not a lot of area or room for sequels in that way. So the problem that you have is, when you can only do Portal and Possession, you have to find ways to get to the Possession and the Portal that are different. And what what the way that they tried to do that in Ghostbusters 2 was through the slime and the goo. That was basically them trying to do a commentary on the attitudes in New York at the time. You know, they're making a movie in a period of time where Times Square is still the prostitution and drug haven of New York. New York City is not the premier tourist destination that it is now. And they're trying to make a commentary on coming together and on getting, you know, starting to get our groove back and starting to be nicer to one another and kind of fight this reputation people have of New Yorkers. And so they use the slime to kind of get that message across to still get to the shell, breaking the shell that is over the museum so that they can get in and they can do the thing in the third act. If they're going to do Zool, and I would totally expect them to make Zool a dude instead of a female this go-around, they're going to have to find a new way to get to Portal and Possession. And I don't necessarily know what the new way to get to Portal and Possession is, unless you're just going to turn the movie into a big commentary on sexism.
Which, the way people have reacted to this, I can see them going that way.
But, that's the inherent problem with turning the Ghostbusters into a franchise, is that Portal and Possession are pretty much the only way you can go, and you just got to find new ways to get there.
I'm curious to see what way they're going to go, assuming that, you know, we get a sequel, which I think we will with a $50 million opening.
Well, we know from the leaked emails, right? We know what the plan was. The plan was a Gosling... The plan was a Gosling, Tatum, Ghostbusters movie, a male-centric Ghostbusters movie, that would then cross over with the female Ghostbusters movie into an Avengers-style event.
I never liked that idea because it's like, well, if you have, like...
Well, I like the idea because I like the idea of getting it the hell out of New York City. Well, I like the idea of opening up different Ghostbusters offices around the country to deal with paranormal activities that happen in New York, in L.A., or Chicago, or Miami, or Atlanta, or New Orleans, or Houston, or Vegas, or anywhere else. And that way you get a new city to explore, you get new ghosts, and you get a new portal that can open up, and more chaos that can ensue.
Yeah, having in different locations actually does work. When I heard the news, I don't know why I always read it as they're just going to be in New York too, which is like, well, why?
The original email said that the idea was that they would be in like L.A. or Boston or New York or Chicago. Like they would be in a different location.
Okay.
Because it would be a branch of the Ghostbusters offices.
That works better to me than having them all in New York is just like, why?
And I think the idea was to take the blonde chick who does all the technology, her to go and set up the new office.
Okay.
So that way you have a tie-in, a Nick Fury type to tie the two movies.
I can get with that, but the way people have reacted to this, and I think it's mostly because it's just women, I don't think they can actually go and do the all guys thing again, just because people will be like, the way I've heard these spiteful Ghostbusters fans, I think they would, even if they hated the guys one, they would go out and double down and support that one just to be like, we don't like them bitches. And I don't know if Sony wants to be put in that place. Sony's not in the best place as it is, so I don't know if they want to actually like put themselves in that place.
Well, I'm grateful they decided to do MIB 21 Jump Street crossover instead of Ghostbusters 21 Street Jump Street crossover, because I'm glad that the franchise got a reboot, and I'm glad that the franchise got its own chance to be its own thing again. I like the idea because most of this movie was filmed in Boston. That's where Feig's from. That's where he has all his connections. That's where he filmed it's where he filmed his movie with McCarthy and The Heat. It's where he filmed The Heat. You know, Like, you can go and set this movie somewhere else, have it be a male and female team, a male-centric team, and do that, and then cross them over into Zool. Like, have Zool be the Loki of the situation, and have that be the great threat that brings them both together. Like, I'm fine with that.
I mean,
even if you wanted to make it like a second female team, or even just a hybrid team of half men, half women.
I think if they go along with it, I think it'll have to be hybrid.
And Tammy Gosling can be there. Just add Emma Stone, although she passed on this one.
That's rare she did, yeah.
Add Emma Stone and like Elizabeth Banks. And you've got Gosling and her, Emma Stone and Gosling are getting ready to do La La Land, the musical. I mean, they've been in a bunch of stuff together. So they
Monster Squad, something else, yeah.
They clearly have chemistry.
Not a bad idea.
So I mean, split it, make it Gosling and Tatum, although he'll be busy filming Gambit soon.
Yeah.
Split it with Gosling and Tatum, and then do Stone and Banks, and then you can cross them over with Melissa McCartney and Kristen Wiig, and do that whole thing.
I can live with that. I'm more interested in actually seeing sequels now than I would have been after walking out of the movie. So maybe that is a direction they can go. It's so many different variables, particularly because it's Sony, and Sony needs...
Well, only question is, like, we both agree that there should have been a Man of Steel 2 to get you to Dawn of Justice.
Yeah.
Would it be required to do a Ghostbusters 2 to get to a crossover event? Or can you just go do a hybrid team and then come back and instead of doing Ghostbusters 2... with this all-female cast, do the hybrid, do the crossover movie.
If you're doing a full hybrid, like, these four other people come from somewhere else and, like, okay, we're going to compare notes, no, I think you should, like, actually build that other one up. If you're going to bring in, like, let's say two of those other people, and instead of them coming from somewhere else, they just recruit them into the team, and you take that shortcut, you can do that, because you can introduce two more characters and not take away anything. If you're trying to establish a whole
what you would say is do Ghostbusters 2, introduce two new Ghostbusters, and then have them spin off into the second team. Because what I'm saying is you do the four other Ghostbusters, set it in Vegas, and then the four Ghostbusters in New York run into Zool, and they call up the other four Ghostbusters, or the blonde girl says, "Hey, I know these other guys who might be able to help us."
In a perfect world, I would go with your plan. In this world, I think they have, if they're going to try to build out more Ghostbusters, I think they need to ride this team and bring some more people into it.
See, I think you can take McCartney. I think you can take Wiig and move Wiig, get Wiig onto that Vegas Ghostbusters. And then she goes back to New York because she gets the call about Zool, and she brings them with her. Mm. And we know Wiig can carry her own movie, and so can Tatum and Gosling. And that way, she's been a part of both teams. She knows both sets of people. And that way, you can have Zool and have the big dynamic threat.
I'm not thinking about it more from a story point. I'm thinking more about the reception, just because of what this movie is. And if I'm Sony, I don't want to... There's already this divide with the fan base as it is. I don't want to further divide and actually give them someone to rally around in another team and be like, this is my Ghostbusters team. Not this one over here. This is the one. This is my Ghostbusters, instead of them
embracing them all. That's why I have Wiig there. You can't embrace the team if Wig's on it. If you hate the female Ghostbusters...
You should logically hate Wiig. However, you've seen the stuff on the internet with these guys. There's not a whole lot of logic with them. We started off this thing talking about how logical your response was. There's not a whole lot of logic with these dudes. So I really would imagine they'd be like, I like all these dudes, but you can take the chick from the first one off. And that would be their mentality going out.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. Like I said, back when Reitman was promoting Draft Day, he had to put the hiatus on it and say, let's just make one good movie first. They've made one good movie now. Let's see where their plans are. And North Korea isn't going to hack them anytime soon. So I don't think that we'll find out.
Yeah, that's going to be a big thing. Well, any other things you want to touch on?
Yeah, 45 to $50 million opening will be solid. It'll probably be enough to top Secret Life of Pets. I mean, if Pets takes a 50% drop, it hits $50 million, so...
Yeah, wait, Pets came out last week, right?
$109 million.
How much was the... Do you remember how much the drop for Dory was?
Drop for Dory was like 44%, 45%, I think.
Okay, I thought it was less than 50. And if Pets drops less than 50, they'll probably beat Ghostbusters.
Right. Which will just be another feather in the cap of those rooting against the
movie. I think it'll do just enough to beat it. It might be close.
It seems to me like Sony was afraid. Like, they didn't release a trailer till April. And then they went so far overboard on the marketing that they ruined every funny moment in the movie.
I guess they were afraid, but the marketing for this movie just sucked. None of the trailers were good.
Kobe and Carmelo, and Adrenas Legauskas.
But all that stuff was better than the actual trailers. The trailers made the movie look like a complete dumpster fire, which it is not. So
the Fantastic Four by Josh Trank, this is not.
No, yeah, that when you see dumpster fire in the dictionary, there needs to be like a gif or gif, whatever you want to call it, of that movie. Like Johnny Storm flaming on and doing something with the rest of them around there. Because that is a dumpster fire. This is just an okay movie, and it's a solid foundation to start from. So I hope it beats Pets. I think it'll end up being closer than it should have been originally, but...
Hey, Dory, Pets and Dory are both on track to make more money than Inside Out did last summer. Think about that for a second.
That is insane to me. Because I liked both of those. I like
Dory. Inside Out finished at like the third highest grossing movie of 2015. And both these movies are on track to beat it in terms of box office.
I think it has to do with the fact that there aren't a whole lot of good movies this summer, and they're both kids movies, and people have been waiting for this damn Pets movie for a year, and Dory for 15 years.
Except for the big friendly giant.
All right. Well, that'll do it for this episode of Movies on the Brain. If you want to follow this podcast, you can find me on Twitter at The Mess Theory.
And I am at BCW Tiger Fan. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again next week.